This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hello.
Our film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hey, Katie.
So we have a lot to talk about on this week's episode. At the end, we're going to have Richard talking to Joe Wright, the director of The Darkest Hour, which is the film about Winston Churchill. And we'll also be joined by Rebecca Keegan, who was at the Academy's Governors Awards on Saturday and has lots of stories to tell from that. But first of all, we'll get into the biggest release of the week, which is Justice League. Richard, your review went live at, I think, 3 a.m., 2:50 a.m. The embargo was very strange.
It was 2:50 a.m. Eastern time, so right just before midnight on the West Coast.
The time where everyone is just waiting for it.
The true witching hour. Yeah.
I love that. That's such a troll. It's such brilliant troll.
There were a lot of troll elements of this whole thing. I mean, they were really, you know, like they were really withholding about when the screening was going to be.
Right.
And then when you got to the screening, there was a press notes thing that was about the width of an Ian McEwan novel. I mean, it was not too long, but long enough. I mean, it was just like, they're really just kind of like, I don't know. It's a funny approach to how this movie.
Why did they even bother showing it to critics at this point? It's just like,
that's a really good question. I don't know. With many things, I'm indignant about that. I'm like, no, the critics should see it. Like, you know, like regardless of what they think, if the movie's gonna be good. But this, it's like, guys,
it's like a Sean Spicer press conference. It's just like, there's no point. Just put the movie out.
Yeah. Even weirder was the screening I went to last night was a mixed critic and general audience. And there was a big disclaimer on the screen, in front of, it was like 80% general audience in this big IMAX theater. And there was a big disclaimer on the screen that was like, please don't talk about this on social media until opening day. And I was like, oh, really? That's going to work on all these people in the IMAX theater? They're not going to talk about what they just saw on social media. What the point is that, why would you do that?
Especially because there were already tweets out from like last week. There was like a junket screening and they put an embargo on reviews, but not on social media. So like there were already tweets. It's just like, I don't know. These things are mystifying to me, but.
And there's the whole mishmash about how Rotten Tomatoes isn't going to be releasing a score. Like all the reviews are out, but presumably as we record this, there's no score on Rotten Tomatoes and they're going to reveal it on their Facebook show. But Warner Brothers also has a minority stake in their parent company. It's all messy.
Yeah, the whole Rotten Tomatoes score reveal feels very much like our president being like, stay tuned, I'm going to announce the Supreme Court, and I'm gonna, it's very like, it's like this. These are things that should not be.
Many people say this film is 96% fresh.
Right.
What's fascinating is the way the reactions are divided. You know, there are these, and Richard's grappling with them today, thanks to his review, I think. But like, there are these ride or die DC fanboys who see this Rotten Tomatoes withholding the score as an evil move against Warner Brothers, as to say, like, either they're hiding a good score, which they're not, or they're putting too much of a spotlight on the reveal of a bad score. Like that's the DC fanboy sort of theory about it. Whereas the rest of us are like, no, they're doing nothing but a favor for Warner Brothers by holding back this score as long as possible.
Yeah, you might be more plugged into this particular mindset than I am, Joanna. But like, the thing about the DC thing, I get like that these are loyal. You know, they like the comics. They're rooting for the movies. They like the shows, presumably. But like, we've now had a successive, other than Wonder Woman, like a pretty four movie now run where the movies have, I mean, to my mind, have not been good, and that's been the general critical consensus. why is there still this kind of conspiracy theory? Like, I mean, I just don't understand. Like, is it impossible for these fans to accept that the movies just maybe aren't good?
I mean, there's this weird, I mean, let's not go too deep into it because it's crazy, but there is this weird Marvel versus DC competition that's been going on since the dawn of time. And, it's almost like, not to make it too political, the Trump supporters who, like, no matter what Trump does, they will support him because they supported him in the first place. And that's what they do. And they're sort of like dug in on it. You know what I mean? So consider them the like rural farmer interviewed in a diner in the middle of who's like, Trump's still doing great. You know, like that's who the DC fanboys are. So,
but is it, I mean, do they like the movies? Do they think for them, are the movies good?
That's it's a good question, Mike.
I mean, do those people like Trump?
Well, I mean, like, in other words, I'm a Yankee fan. So just to take it out of, because I,
sure.
I'm a Yankee fan, right? So, and like, I hate the Red Sox. I basically hate Boston.
I have to leave.
It's totally irrational. And if the Yankees do most of the things the Yankees do, there's one rare occasions where I'm like, okay, now that's enough already. You know what I mean? Like, right. A-Rod was where I was kind of like drawing a line. But up until then, all of the sort of like things that the Yankees do that aren't maybe like, no one else likes, I'm like, fine, whatever. That's my team. And as long as they win or sometimes they don't win, I still love them. So is that, it's that. It's team sports, basically?
Well, it's team sports, but I think it's also they're slowly losing the people who were like, you know, because a bunch of people like Man of Steel. I didn't, but a bunch of people did. And then fewer people like Batman v Superman and fewer people like Suicide Squad and fewer. I think once people see Justice League, it's just going to keep winnowing down to these like core zealots. And then the core zealots get, I think, almost a little scarier the smaller their numbers are. You
right.
Know? So,
But Richard and the critics, happening. You're in the position of like the refs or the umpires. You know,
well, I mean,
it's like you guys are deciding in some way, at least in their minds, if this thing is a success or a failure. And so there's an effort to kind of like work the refs.
Well, yeah. And there's a very we've talked about this thing before, either on the website or on the podcast. This funny dichotomy between on one measure, the critics don't matter, like whoever, like, you know, you're just a shill for Marvel, whatever. But then they also are so invested in what the reviews say. So it's this kind of like, they really want you to say nice things about this thing.
It's really
and
hard
then they dismiss it if you
going
don't.
Going back to the political metaphor.
It really
here,
is.
But yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was interesting around Wonder Woman because, you know, as Richard, I do want to get to Richard's great review because it's so good and I love when Richard's angry, but in that review, he mentions the fact that like Wonder Woman was this just very bright spot of the year in terms of like, you know, I liked it. A lot of people loved it, you know, but critics liked it. Audiences liked it. It's really nice when we can all get along and just be like, what a nice movie, mm-hmm. you know? But even then there was a rotten core of the DC fanship that was angry that the critics like this movie. You know, they're angry no matter what. And, I don't know how to solve that. So but all I want, I'll tell you this much. I don't care about Marvel or DC partisanship. All I want is a good movie and Justice League is not a good movie. So, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like, I had more than a few people tell me on Twitter last night, this morning that I, you know, well, I just went in wanting to hate it. And it's like, okay, maybe there's some truth to that. But like in general, if I have to see a movie for my job, and write about it, like it would be great if I loved it. Like that would be nice. I would I'd rather have a pleasant 2 hours or a really positive 2 hours than like not being, you know, into it. So
well, I'm curious. So you opened the door, like maybe there's some truth to that. What's the truth to it?
Well, just that I haven't liked the past movies, you know, except for Wonder Woman.
You're going in at least bracing to be.
Well, yeah, I mean,
unhappy.
And I think that like the assumption that I could review this in a vacuum when by very design, this is the next installment in a franchise in the same way that Thor Ragnarok was the next installment in the Avengers. You know, it's like these are built to be successive experiences.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I'm going to bring in what I saw before into the new thing. You know, I think
that Wonder Woman would kind of make you want to like it more? Like there was a sense over the summer, it's like, oh, well, Wonder Woman might mark a new direction for them. And this is going to be kind of a more cohesive DC universe. So I think there was almost more hope for this than maybe for Batman versus Superman.
And of course I was, you know, and also like I was a kid who was read Star Wars novels and liked, you know, X-Men trading cards. Like there's a part of me still many years later that wants to go in and see a cool superhero movie. Like I'm totally on board for that idea. So and based on Wonder Woman, I was like, well, you know, hope against hope, the Joss Whedon factor. actor, like maybe this is going to be something good. And then it's just, I mean, it's really astonishingly a poorly put together movie, like in a way that Suicide Squad, while I hate it and I think it's a really annihilating movie, at least had some sort of perverse point of view. Whereas this one is just like, it just feels like it was made either by committee or, I think I said in the review, by like an algorithm. It's just so.
Well, when you know, Zack Snyder had to leave the production because of very tragic events that happened in his family. And so Joss Whedon came on to sort of a finish the movie, but then by some reports that I read, basically reshoot a good portion of the movie, which you can tell because this was also reported in the trades. Henry Cavill had grown a mustache, who plays Superman, had grown a mustache for Mission Impossible. They need him for reshoots. He refused to shave the mustache, so they CGI deleted his mustache from all the reshots.
You can tell. So you can totally tell.
You can tell. Yeah. And it's a helpful way to track what's a reshoot and what's not, because if he's got like this frozen Botox lip, you're like, oh, it's a reshot scene.
Real Housewives of Metropolis kind of frozen face.
I look forward to the James Franco comedy about this, about the production of this film.
Yeah.
But the tone is so different. And like Richard mentioned this as in his review, it's crazy to think that you can just graft a Whedon tone, a light, zippy, we're having fun, aren't we having fun tone on top of what Zack Snyder has been doing all along in this universe. And those, like, as much as I love Whedon, which, and I do, I love Whedon, I love the humor. And like, if you put sort of Ezra Miller's stuff as a Flash in a vacuum, cause he gets the brunt of the comic relief stuff, I enjoy that movie in a vacuum, but it jangles out of tune when you put it with everything else that's going on. And so it's crazy that they thought that they could just like slap some Whedon on there and it would work, and it doesn't.
Especially because Whedon is so associated with the other rival franchise. It's just like an odd, I don't know, kind of thing. But I guess what I'm curious about, and something I sort of ended my review on, you know, was saying that like, oh, poor Gal Gadot, like she looks so sad in this, like she just made this movie that people liked. And you know, I did make sure Justice League was filmed pretty soon after Wonder Woman was filmed. So I'm just projecting on you know, the movie. But like Wonder Woman has had a pretty not that quiet awards campaign. Like they've been screening it for, you know,
Couldn't have put this thing out in January.
I wonder, or
April.
Does this hobble that movie, that, you know, Wonder Woman's, I don't think that Wonder Woman was actually going to get the Best Picture nomination they're clearly gunning for.
Right.
But like, I think that this might be the fatal blow to whatever hope existed.
I like the way you brought this into awards.
Hey,
yeah.
Well played. <I do too.
laughs> Well, and it's too bad. I think what's clear, what I originally meant to get to, but I got off the point. What's clear about the Whedon reshoots is they tried to lean really heavily on, hey, remember you liked Wonder Woman? So there's a lot of mention of Chris Pine's character from Wonder Woman in this film that to me feels a result of the reshoots. And
wait, even though he's just like literally dead in this movie, right?
Yeah.
And been dead for 100 years.
I mean,
yeah, sorry, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Superheroes love talking about dead people that they love. So, you know, they're like, my dad and mom.
They're going to do a chamber drama where it's just Captain America and Wonder Woman talking about their like dead old people that they loved once or whatever.
I'm here for it. But so that was really evident. But, you know, I sort of ranted about this on Twitter this morning. But like the way that just the way that the camera treats Gal Gadot, who is a beautiful actress and is beautiful in Wonder Woman, but is like leered at in Justice League, it really undercuts like so much of the uplifting like and like classy treatment of the Wonder Woman story that Patty Jenkins did. Like that to me, that struck me as a very classy film. And so I can understand why it was trying for some sort of Oscar or something. And Justice League really, really blows that up, I think.
No, I agree. And you know,
my favorite part of your review is that poor Aquaman doesn't get to go in the water.
I mean, there's one scene in the water, essentially. Like, and, you know, I made a joke. I linked to an old Simpsons episode or a scene where they're watching a show called Night Boat, you know, like Knight Rider. And they're like, you know, now they're going on land. We can't do anything. And they're like, oh, no, there's a canal. And they're like, there's always a canal or a fjord or an inlet or something. And I'm like, just give Aquaman the canal, you know, like provide some water next to where everything else is happening.
I think give Guillermo del Toro should do the Aquaman movie.
Yes. Jason Momoa, I mean, the underwater scenes Injustice League are a disaster and make me really worried for the solo Aquaman movie. Yeah. What Jason Momoa is doing with Aquaman, which is like basically Aqua Bro, is just really very confounding to me. And then the last thing I'll say is that there is a part where he like surfs a dead alien body through the air.
Oh God, I forgot about that. Yeah.
So I think he kind of treats water as if it's air, as if it's water too. Maybe like the droplets of moisture in the air allow him to manipulate it. I don't know.
It's like some midichlorians explainer right there.
You know, I can only try, Katie. I can only try.
So this movie's going to make money anyway. Like all signs point to it being like yet another superhero hit because apparently everyone will just go keep seeing them. Does that depress us about the future of this franchise, or does it just feel like this is gonna be par for the course and we're just gonna have to deal with this superhero franchise that isn't actually that good?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's I think that they're gonna see diminishing returns. I mean, I think that Wonder Woman was in the sort of DC narrative as it exists right now. Like, I think that Wonder Woman was kind of anomalous. Like, I think it was, I don't know. I mean, I don't, I honestly don't see this movie performing as well. And maybe that will be some bellwether. I could be totally wrong. I thought the same thing about Suicide Squad, and clearly I was wrong to the tune of like $800 million or however much it was. So
the worldwide, the ranking of the DCEU, which is what they call it so far, is Batman v Superman is 873 million worldwide. Wonder Woman 821 million worldwide. Suicide Squad 745 and Man of Steel 668. So I say it comes in around Suicide Squad numbers.
Okay.
Like, it's not going to capture, I don't think it's going to capture the Batman v Superman, like, look how many characters we have in our movie, don't you just love them sort of vibe, because people got burned by Batman v Superman. I know a lot of people who are not going to see this movie.
I mean, I had at least two people tell me on Facebook today, oh, I was going to take my kid to that, but I think I still have to take him because he wants to see it, you know? So
well,
people are still going to go.
I mean,
people are still going
to
go.
But for all the posturing of, like, we don't care about, to your question, Katie, are we just stuck with this franchise forever, in this vein forever? For all their posturing of we don't care about what the critics say, I think WB, we know what WB much, much more enjoyed what happened around Wonder Woman than what happened around Batman v Superman, even though Batman v Superman made them $50 million more dollars, right? And so I think they are going to keep trying to recalibrate to chase that Wonder Woman thing. It was too late with Justice League because there's already too much like work done on it to completely course correct. But with something like the solo Flash movie or Wonder Woman 2, or like getting Ben Affleck out of the franchise and casting a new Batman or whatever it is, or Joss Whedon's Batgirl, whatever's coming, I think we're going to see them chasing that. And in that way, the franchise does have a hope of getting better. But I think just given production schedules, there was no way Justice League was going to be able to course correct smoothly more than just slapping some Joss Whedon lightness and humor on top of Zack Snyder's whatever.
Yeah, I mean, this is the studio that had the superhero movies that made people take superhero movies seriously. I mean, they had The Dark Knight, which everyone wanted to get a Best Picture nomination. You can imagine that they're still attached to that and still, you know, with their Wonder Woman campaign, want to get back to that point, even if they seem so far from it right now.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with their romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman? And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people and a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now?
What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/LittleGoldMen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/LittleGoldMen.
So we're now joined by our Hollywood correspondent, Rebecca Keegan, who was recently at the, what I think you called the first really stop on the sort of road to Oscars, right? This weekend, the Governor's Awards?
Yeah, this is the first big event that has all the contenders out. And it's usually one of the more pleasant nights of Oscar season because nobody's lost anything yet. Everybody is technically in the race and they're all sort of there styled and looking gorgeous and feeling upbeat. This year was different because of course, the Harvey Weinstein et cetera scandals that are roiling the industry.
Right. And so I'm curious because, you know, this is a on one hand, a really nice celebratory night because someone like, you know, Agnès Varda, the wonderful, you know, French director at 89 years old gets an honorary Oscar, and Angelina Jolie, who seems to be a new friend of hers, presents it to her. And, you know, Donald Sutherland is honored for his long body of work. So there's that. But also, obviously, like you said, there's this darkness really now kind of poisoning, I don't spoiling anything this year. So what was the mood like kind of in the room?
It was fascinating the extent to which there were the conversations people were having during the cocktail hour and around the long dinner tables that the studios all buy for their films. All anybody was talking about was the harassment issues. That's all anybody wanted to talk about. And yet on stage, it was like this twilight zone where none of this was happening and nobody acknowledged it. And it was especially interesting to me when I reflected on last year's award season, in which people were talking about the election so much. And you had this sort of, you know, incredible Meryl Streep speech at the Golden Globes about Trump. You had people talking at the SAG Awards as the Muslim ban was being rolled out. And it really felt like topical was okay. Like, and not only okay, you know, people were really engaged. This year, the topic is right here in our own backyards, and people are, at least at this first event, seemingly very reserved about talking about it on mic.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got a major difference here, which is the home team is the one with the problem now, right?
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
And I think the more you think about the Academy's connection to this long-standing issue that has just sort of burst into the public in a new way, the darker it looks, as far as I can tell. I mean, you've still got, as far as I know, Woody Allen and Roman Polanski are, you know, have not been censured in any way by the Academy ever. Harvey Weinstein has basically made his name by hacking Oscar campaigning. Kevin Spacey has how many Oscars? Two Oscars. James Toback was going around using his Oscar nomination as, you know, a pickup line to hundreds and hundreds of women. How, like, do you think people are get this that the Academy has to do something serious to get out of the enabling business?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, among the industry groups that have responded, the Academy is one of the Academy, which of course has this reputation for being glacial in dealing with current events, was actually among the first to do something in that they booted Harvey Weinstein, and they're now coming up with a code of conduct. Yeah. For them, that's pretty radical and actually kind of controversial in a way.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, last night, look, the whole industry, not just the Academy, the whole industry is wringing its hands and pointing fingers. Last night, I was at this event at the Screen Actors Guild, where Gloria Allred was there talking to SAG members about sort of what to do if you're harassed, what your legal recourse is. And of course, you know, I'm talking to SAG members who are waiting in line to get into the event, and they're saying, all of them can name, you know, a casting director who's known in their circle to be predatory, other actors, directors, producers. So it's kind of across the industry. And of course, we're interested in award season and how it impacts that. But as with the Oscar So White controversy, it's really the Academy's really reflecting this kind of industry-wide issue.
Right. But so far, it sounds like, I guess, while they're in process of trying to figure out what they're going to do, I guess they don't want to really say anything out loud. Is that what, is that your sense?
Well, yeah. And I keep asking them and they keep saying, well, we'll get back to you. So, I mean, they're trying to figure it out. They're they have a group which is meeting and trying to come up with the code of conduct. They're, at least according to this letter that the Academy CEO Don Hudson sent to members, they're consulting with sort of ethics experts and legal experts to figure out the best way to do this, figure out a way for people to bring complaints forward and have them dealt with in a way that does not ruin the career of the person bringing the allegation. It's all really complicated and thorny stuff. And some Academy members have said to me that they're really concerned about creating this sort of atmosphere of fear and intimidation in the industry where, you know, you can bring forward an allegation and you're anonymous, but, you know, maybe you are sort of seeking revenge against someone who hurt you professionally. I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which coming up with a system is, while necessary, potentially fraught.
And sort of, I'm curious, like, lower to the ground, sort of beyond the institutional level, like, you know, you said, like, at the tables and at the cocktail hour that people were, that's what, this is what people were talking about. Are these people talking about it in sort of guarded terms? Are they saying, you know, or is it, if they talk about it like a something that's not far away necessarily, but not sort of in their own backyard, so to speak? Like, are people kind of, I don't know, in the industry in LA, like, sort of owning it or distancing themselves from it? Like, how did those conversations go?
Well, a lot of people were sharing individual stories of, you know, one producer was talking to me about a Kevin Spacey project that he has going and trying to figure out what to do with that project. I mean, it's already shot, so what's he going to do? Another person who works at a studio was telling me a story about an interaction he had with Harvey Weinstein when he used to work for him. So some of it is kind of like sharing war stories. And then there's also the whispers about the people who have not yet had press accounts about them. You know, this kind of I feel like, you know, every day when I get into the office, I kind of play whack-a-mole with rumors. It's, have you heard about this person? Have you heard about that person? Who's next? So there's sort of the whisper campaign going on. So yeah, I mean, it's very close to the ground in the sense that everybody's talking about their own personal interaction with it. It was also sort of interesting to see the way Dustin Hoffman's evening unfolded. He had been sort of accused of sexually harassing an intern in a Hollywood Reporter story in 1985. He apologized for that. And he was out in this case to present to Owen Roisman, the cinematographer, and also he was representing his movie, The Meyerowitz Stories. He took the stage. He received a very sort of warm round of applause from the audience of his peers. But it was interesting to me that during the cocktail hour, he sort of sat quietly at his table with his wife, and he wasn't making the rounds in the room, which pretty much everybody else was. So I think that was sort of an example of someone who is kind of at the center of this controversy, though the things he's was accused of are far less egregious than some of these other people we're talking about. And you see how he's kind of navigating it and how people are not entirely sure how to navigate it with him. It's complicated.
It is complicated. And I it's interesting that, you know, in a sort of social context, I mean, it's half work, half, you know, fun, something like that, that people are still sort of talking about it on the kind of, you know, granular anecdotal level. And so it doesn't seem to you, Rebecca, that, like, you know, there had been some fear that there were a fatigue was going to set in and say, like, oh, we can't talk about anyone else. Like, it's enough, you know, but like that ball still seems to be rolling.
Well, look, nobody ever has had enough of the gossip.
Right. Well, of course,
people may eventually have enough of the sort of, how do we fix this conversation? Mm-hmm. People tend to get bored with that real fast. Nobody gets bored with gossiping about people in the industry. Even at an event like the Governor's Awards, which I would say the ratio was like 75% work, 25% fun at that particular event.
But what about the kind of idea of a backlash? I mean, do you sense a backlash brewing in any sense, or is it still kind of people just trying to figure out, like, which end is up and is there a floor to this, you know, endless series of allegations?
I know people are worried about a backlash. And one of the things, there've been a lot of closed door conversations happening among powerful women in Hollywood, women at the agencies, women at the studios, trying to figure out what they're worried about is they see this as many of them as a sort of key moment when this industry issue is finally coming to the fore. And they are worried about people bringing forth allegations that might threaten this moment, you know, things that end up ultimately being disproven or people whose careers are hurt. And it ultimately is revealed that the accuser was not honest. A lot of these sort of behind the scenes, a lot of these powerful women are worried about that sort of taking away the momentum from this movement.
Right, right. In a sort of a Duke LaCrosse style, you know,
exactly
explosion that leads to a lot of doubt.
Right.
One false story kind of removing the just calling into doubt all the other allegations, which are in likelihood true.
Yeah. Yeah.
On a lighter note, I mean, you know,
please, Richard, give me a lighter note. I would love a lighter note.
Such a thing is possible. So, you know, this is also an event that's taking the temperature of, you know, all this stuff aside, if that's possible, of an award season and, you know, a very uncertain one, you know, was there anything or anybody who was there, that clarified anything for you? I mean, I think it's, you know, I know that they've become buddies. I kind of joked about it, but, you know, that Jolie was there, you know, to present Agnes Varda with this award, you know, was probably more of a personal thing. But does that mean that Jolie is still in the hunt for First They Killed My Father? Like, did you pick up any of those frequencies?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, she, Varda had actually four women who presented her. Jolie was the last one, but also Jessica Chastain, director Kimberly Pierce. And I can't remember who the fourth woman was, but yes, pretty much everybody who was there presenting had some sort of professional reason of their own to do it. One thing that was interesting to me to note is that in a room full of the most famous of the famous, the extent to which people were so excited to stop by Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg. Mm. You know, The Post is one of the few movies that we have not yet seen. It starts screening, I think, next week. And they are really among, in a room of celebrities, they are the celebrities. So, of course, you know, the jury's out on how the movie is, but just in terms of the extent to which the town likes them and wants their movie to be good, that came across in just the number of people who are excited to meet them and talk to them.
Has anyone seen it? Like in town?
Not that I know of. I mean, I know Spielberg was just at an event last week for Rebecca Miller's movie, and he told some reporters, I think Ann Thompson wrote a piece, that he had literally just locked it and was doing the sound mix.
Wow,
so
great.
People may have seen, you know, clips of it. They may have seen some footage, but he hadn't finished as of last week. And the first screenings I know of, I think, are next week.
Yeah. I mean, just anecdotally, like when we were had a meeting of the New York Film Critics Circle to vote on new members, this was a few weeks ago now, the word then was that John Williams was still putting the finishing touches on his score. So like it's
right.
They're really, you know, putting this thing together till the end.
I mean, they moved at a really quick pace from when they started production on it. So I'm excited to see it. I think that comes at an interesting time in terms of the themes that it's about. You have this, you know, Meryl Streep playing this powerful woman, Katharine Graham. You have the issue of press freedom, which is certainly something that's topical. I could see on paper, it sure looks like something that will appeal to the Academy.
Yeah. Is there any other movie that, you know, from our vantage point, you know, we're looking at Twitter, and that, I don't know how useful that is necessarily, you know, what bunch of critics talking to themselves, but like on the ground there, is there a movie that people are really talking about that seems to you to have? I mean, I saw that, you know, Saoirse Ronan was there at the Governor's Awards for Lady Bird. Like, is there anything kind of popping right now, particularly?
Lady Bird seems to really be catching on with members. It's really interesting to see how many people are responding to that one or excited about it. And, you know, A24, I think, showed last year with Moonlight that they are able to sort of rally a passionate base for a smaller movie and go all the way with it. So it'll be interesting to see if Lady Bird is able to sort of take that momentum and go with it. Dunkirk has also not gone away. You know, it made a splash over the summer, and now they're doing a lot of the awardsy screenings. I went to an event at the DGA for Dunkirk, and people, now that they've seen most of the other movies, that one is continuing to rise to the top in terms of the craft and the sort of level of difficulty. It's sort of like a triple axel movie to a lot of people in terms of how hard what Chris Nolan did is.
Yeah. Those are the two that are jumping out
to me right now. I mean,
that's interesting.
You know, most people have not seen The Phantom Thread. Right. There've been very, very few screenings. I think the big sort of unveil for a lot of people is happening the day after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
For some reason, they love to just ruin Thanksgiving weekend by by screening big movies that weekend in town. So The Phantom Thread, I think people are still waiting. The Post, people are still waiting. But a lot of the other movies now that they've been rolled out, those are the two that seem to be rising to the top among the Academy members I'm talking to. Also, Get Out. It's interesting. Yeah. A lot of Academy members didn't see it the first time around when mainstream audiences did, because they weren't necessarily in the demographic that was being targeted by the marketing. Now they're starting to see it and really responding to it kind of as a satire in the vein of a kind of Stepford Wives, you know. So yeah, that's been interesting to see how Academy members are responding to that film, which is different.
Really great to hear. Yeah. Because I think Lady Bird and Get Out to me are probably the two strongest movies I've seen. I haven't seen everything, but those are the ones that really stand out to me.
Well, and here in New York, you know, MoMA is doing a screening of Get Out in their sort of Contenders series that's I think this week or next. So like, or not probably not next week's Thanksgiving, but like, you know, so that movie, that careful campaign that has been lying dormant for a while is now kicking back.
It seems like they're playing it nicely. Now's a good time to be starting to bubble up, I think, for them.
Well, and it was interesting. It was Chris Tapley of Variety reported that the Golden Globes is treating Get Out as a comedy. And I don't know if you saw, there was a lot of controversy over, is it a comedy? Isn't it a comedy? I thought it was funny that Jordan Peele weighed in on Twitter this morning saying it's a documentary.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a satire, right? Satire is comedy.
Right.
People on Twitter just...
Everybody take it down a notch.
Whatever, yeah.
Also, like, let's just be shrewd. It's maximizing its chances of winning Golden Globes. Like, fine.
Yeah.
Like, I'm fine with that, you know, regardless of quote-unquote category or fraud. All right, Rebecca, well, thank you for that. If people want to read, you did a good write-up of the Governor's Awards on VF.com. Your work is really kicking into gear now. Not that it hasn't been before, but like, I feel like minus the Thanksgiving holiday, I feel like you're going to be pretty busy. So we'll have to.
I'm a farmer at the harvest right now.
Exactly. Perfectly said. All right. Well, we'll be back in touch with you soon, I'm sure. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.
And now we're going to hear my interview with director Joe Wright, whose film Darkest Hour, a not exactly biopic of Winston Churchill, but captures a moment in time just as World War II was ramping up. We talked a lot about where he was in his career before Darkest Hour came along, and maybe a little bit about where he is now that it's done, and also about what it's like to work with Gary Oldman, who's the star of the film and delivers a really towering, transformative performance, and how that works between actor and director. Well, I have the pleasure of having Joe Wright sit across the table from me today, which we're really happy you're here. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You're doing, I think, a multifaceted Vanity Fair experience today. So
I am a bit.
Hope we haven't worn you out.
No, it's all good. But I've just done a video, Anatomy of a Scene, and now I'm here.
Oh, nice. Which scene can you tell us?
Was the scene where Winston's driving through the streets and then makes a decision to get out the car and go and meet the people.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's quite weird, though, because I shot the thing a year ago. So it's difficult to remember the very specific details that were being asked.
That's something I want to talk about is that it was a pretty tight turnaround time for this movie. But just going back, so I saw Darkest Hour at Telluride. Uh-huh. Which was a really receptive audience, a really warm response, it felt like. And I think I saw the second screening of it, not the first one.
Right.
But something that intrigued me, and I wanted to ask you since you said it, when you introduced the film, you said that the movie is a lot about doubt, and that you had been experiencing some doubt in your own life, and so these things kind of dovetailed together. Can you expand a little bit on that, like what you meant in terms of the film and what you meant in terms of your own, you know, career or life or what was going on?
In terms of the film, people always imagine that Churchill never wavered in his conviction But in actual fact, what we find in the records, especially of the cabinet meetings, is that there was a point very early on in his premiership when the British troops were stranded on the beach at Dunkirk, and it looked very much like they were going to get wiped out. And it looked very much like at that point, Germany would try and invade England. And so Churchill was being pushed to negotiate some kind of peace deal with Germany. And in that moment, he considered that option, and he came very close to actually pursuing that option. And so there's a moment within the film, or it's really about, I guess, this moment when he doubts himself, he doubts his conviction, and he, I guess, suffers a crisis of confidence, which then he pulls himself out of. And as mm-hmm. we know, he doesn't do a peace deal and he resists. But that was something I identified with without wanting to get too sort of personal. I'd made a film that had not been well received and had lost the studio a lot of money. And I was down in the dumps. I doubted myself and my abilities. I kind of felt like maybe I had run my course as a director. And I wondered whether the film industry and the audience had changed to the point where I was no longer suited to the task. And that was a moment of doubt, of a crisis of confidence.
I mean, in that kind of personal or professional point, like, did Darkest Hour kind of call to you? I mean, how did you kind of come onto the project? Were you seeking something like that?
Well, what happened was I actually called up Alfonso Cuarón, and he and
a good person to be able to call up when you're feeling.
And I called Alfonso, and we met and had a long chat about it. And I realized that I wasn't the only one who suffers such moments. And he suggested very, very wisely, he said, why don't you just go and watch all the films that made you fall in love with filmmaking in the first place? So I did that. I spent some time watching, you know, everything from Krzysztof Kieślowski, Tarkovsky, Hitchcock, Sidney Lumet, you know, and remembered that it was really drama that I loved. And then I got a call from Charlie Brooker, who asked me to direct an episode of Black Mirror. And I thought that was probably quite a good way of getting back on the horse. It was just a 4-week shoot and a beautiful script with some, you know, and I cast Bryce Dallas Howard, who I love and is an amazing actress. And so I found myself back on set with a great script, great actors, in a room with people talking to each other and communicating, or miscommunicating is more often the case. And I loved it. And I remembered that was what I loved doing. So I was certainly looking to just focus on doing drama and getting back to basics and stripping my aesthetic back a little bit. So then this script turned up actually whilst I was in South Africa shooting Black Mirror. This script turned up and I identified with it, and I always have to identify with the characters that I'm trying to realize.
You're a little young for World War II to have loomed very large, maybe in your childhood imagination. Is that accurate?
Very big. It's very big in my imagination when I was a kid. My dad was born in 1906.
Okay.
And so, you know, he lived through the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And also growing up in London in like the 70s, there were still like big bomb craters everywhere and areas of London that were kind of out of bounds. Or I remember sort of playing in the kind of bomb sites, and you'd kind of climb underneath the corrugated iron that was supposedly kind of stopping kids getting in. You climb under the corrugated iron and go and play in the bomb site. And so, you can't avoid the Second World War in London, and especially the Blitz. You know, so much of London was destroyed at that time. It does loom very large in our imaginations.
And did Churchill specifically factor into that? Like, did you know much about him before you got the script and started working on the movie?
No, I mean, I knew a bit about him, but he wasn't someone who I was particularly interested in, to be frank. He's a giant statue on a giant plinth in Parliament Square. He's the bulldog spirit. He's been co-opted by certain factions of the political spectrum that I don't necessarily adhere to. So he wasn't sort of a great hero of mine as I was growing up, like he has been to so many other people. But that was the point of the movie, was to kind of take down the icon and meet Churchill face to face and see what I could learn from him.
And in doing that, I mean, you need to find the right actor. And it needs to be somebody who is both going to do this remarkable act of transformation, which is what Gary Oldman does in the film, but also works in the broader texture of the movie. So I'm kind of curious how that works when you're dealing with a, you know, you've had some wonderful performances in your films, you know, whether it's Kate Blanchett wielding a pistol or, you know, a young Saoirse Ronan, first kind of arriving in the scene. But like with this is a really towering kind of iconic kind of thing. How do you work with that? And then how much of it is Oldman coming to you with this fully formed? How much of it is a dialogue between the two of you? I'm just curious about the mechanics of a performance like that as a director.
Absolutely. I mean, directing is really, you know, 99% casting. And having made the choice of Gary, I chose Gary in particular because I felt he had the essence of the character. The Churchill that I wanted to realize was a Churchill who was full of a manic, dynamic energy that sometimes resulted in complete collapse. And Gary has that kind of dynamism, really, that sort of intensity. And so I felt it was more important to cast a character, an actor who had the essence of the character rather than the physical appearance of the character. The physical appearance you can fake. So having made that choice of casting Gary, Gary's the Don, you know, in growing up in London in the 80s and 90s, Gary's the Don, he's the man, he's the geezer, you know, he's the tops. And there is no one in our kind of London imaginations that beats him. So he was a huge hero of mine. And I wondered as we began talks, I wondered whether he would be someone who would just want to be kind of left alone to get on with it, and I would arrange everything around him. But actually, I was delighted to discover that he was interested in a complete collaboration, and it's probably the closest collaboration I've ever had with an actor. He wanted direction. Mm-hmm. And he seemed to trust me, and I certainly trusted him. And so we grew to a point of almost sometimes not really needing to finish sentences before the other one knew what you were going to say. You know, it was an extraordinary kind of process.
So I'm curious, like, you know, speaking about doubt, is there a moment when you're on set and Oldman has tweaked this performance to what we see now on screen, and the lighting is right and the day is right? Is there a moment when you say, oh my God, we got it, like this is it? Do you ever feel that? Or is there always a kind of questioning or a wanting of more?
You sometimes feel like you've got that day,
yeah,
or that scene. You wake up every morning with this kind of punch in the gut of adrenaline / fear. You get up, you drink coffee, you plan your day, you do your shot lists. You're terrified that you're not going to get it, that you're not good enough. You work through the day in this level of high anxiety. And at sometimes, if you're lucky, at a certain point during the day, you start to kind of feel like maybe you're going to achieve this. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, if you're lucky, you think, oh, I think I got that. That was really good. And you kind of can relax for an hour, and then the next morning you wake up with the same horror and fear. So it's never, you never feel right. Like you have the whole film.
Right.
You feel like you have pieces.
A little maybe. Piece. Yeah.
I've got that piece. I've got that piece. And slowly you start to put them together. And then you don't know, you know, until you get in the cutting room, whether the thing's going to work as a whole. Really.
Right.
In fact, you don't really know until you put it up in front of an audience.
Really, it's that far into the process.
Yeah.
And you don't make it easier for yourself. I mean, you're known for really artful, intricate shots, and what I like about Darkest Hour a lot, other than the wonderful performances and just the sort of interesting story is that this could be a very staid kind of chamber piece, people talking in rooms, you know, but you add these flourishes that really fit the texture of the movie. how in your mind, when you start conceptualizing how you're going to shoot a film, when do those things happen? I mean, I'm thinking in particular, there's a lovely shot where I think it's Churchill's in an elevator and everything is black around him. And it's almost abstract. Mm. When do those things kind of start to appear in your head, these particular visuals?
They appear sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They start usually on the first reading of the script.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sense of it and ideas will start popping into my head.
And is that a good indicator that this is something you want to work on if
exactly.
that happens?
If you feel like you know a secret about the film, if you feel like you kind of, if there are certain cinematic moments that you can't help but desperately need to see realized, then that's a good indication. And so there are kind of tentpole moments that appear very early. And then you build slowly the joining sequences. So that elevator thing, I think, was actually on the first reading of the script. And I see them in my head. I kind of think cinematically, which is to say, I think in image, sound, time at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's never like a still picture. It's the idea that one is using all the tools of film at the same time.
Yeah, and I think another tool, and Dario Marinelli composed the score for Dark Star. He's a frequent collaborator of yours.
Absolutely.
And that, as it did in Anna Karenina, or, you know, the score featured hugely in Atonement. How crucial do you find that sort of soundscape to be when you're imagining the film, or is that sort of added later?
You get a sense of the tempo of a film, and then you have to work out all the elements that can build to the realization of that mm-hmm. rhythm. I personally feel like film is closest in relation to music than any other art form, because of rhythm. I really enjoy rhythm. And, so early on in pre-production, I start talking to Dario and I send him the script. And then I think the first piece of music he composed was based on a photograph that of Gary as Winston walking, and we talked about this kind of thriller, political thriller aesthetic rhythm, and so Gary's pace was really important to the realization of that. So I sent Dario this piece of this photograph. I also referenced some kind of fairly modern minimalist music, wanted quite a minimalist score. So all of those conversations, he then took that stuff and started to create themes.
Mm-hmm.
I would then play that music on set to give Gary a sense of the rhythm of the music.
Yeah.
And then I would have that music in the cutting room from the get-go.
So it's pretty thoroughly integrated into that's really cool.
I try not to do it like stage by stage,
right,
but integrate everything as I'm going along.
So you said, you know, you said you reminded us that you were shooting something a year ago, and this film it began production kind of late in 2016, right? Is that correct? Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, between Their Finest and Dunkirk and Darkest Hour, there's obviously a recurring Dunkirk-y theme happening in British cinema right now. Do you think that that is an accident? Do you think that there is something about that moment in time that, maybe it's Brexit, I don't know, is speaking to Britons and filmmakers in particular? Or
yeah, it's odd. I mean, when I started work on the film in January 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And so Brexit hadn't happened and Trump hadn't happened and the French elections and Dutch elections. And so the film certainly didn't feel topical at all. And then as we went into pre-production, Brexit happened and the film took on a kind of topicality that was very surprising. I thought about investing the film with more of my own political opinions, but every time I tried to do that, it felt didactic and felt kind of preachy. So I actually stripped it back again and tried to focus entirely on the very specific character that we had, the very specific time, and also the very specific enemy that we were facing. And I feel that it's the filmmaker's job, the storyteller's job, to present certain questions and scenarios and then respect the audience enough to be able to make up their own minds, rather than try and sort of give any answers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's something that really works well about the movie, is that it lets you infer.
Yeah.
It doesn't beat you over the head.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a moment in time, and we can take from it what we will.
Yeah.
We don't.
And
we don't,
I think,
you know,
that, you know, it's in times of uncertainty like we're going through now, I think we would do well to look at our history and try and learn from it, learn from experience. Only a fool doesn't learn from experience, you know. And so, but without, you know, I really wanted to avoid this kind of nostalgia for the past as well. Mm-hmm. You know, things weren't better then. Things were worse then than they are now. It's not about, oh, I wish it were like this when, you know, blah, blah, blah. For me, it's just about trying to understand and learn something from where we come from.
And I think the film provides that, you know. I think it's really cool, and you know, whatever doubt you were coming from, I think hopefully the reception of this film has laid that some, or I don't know, maybe it's,
well, I think yeah, the making of the film has actually,
yeah,
and what I've discovered in that process is that doubt is a key factor for progress, you know. So I'm very glad I had that experience.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for talking to us. Darkest Hour opens in the US next week, November 22nd. But yeah, we'll see you at the premiere tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thanks.
Look forward to it.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That does it for this week's episode of Little Gold Men. Thank you, as always, for listening. Please find us and rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts or really whatever podcast app you choose to use. You can find us all at VanityFair.com, writing about Justice League and award season and everything else. We're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men, where we love to hear from you. And we're all on our own on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich. Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
And Richard?
Rylaws.
And Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Jordan Bell, and thanks to Andy Bowers at Panoply.
And this week's award for the best description of soon-to-be-departing Vanity Fair editor-in-chief Graydon Carter goes to Joe Wright.
Is the Don, is the man, is the geezer, you know, is the tops.
Know that fizzy feeling you get when you read something really good, watch the movie everyone's been talking about, or catch the show the internet can't get over? At the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we chase that feeling 5 times a week. We talk about the buzziest movies, TV, music, books, and more. From lowbrow to highbrow to in between, catch the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
From PRX.